At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
Fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with your card and a digital coupon. Then buy one, get one free on our full line sale of tender Tyson chicken with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
They are Sports Illustrated.
It's amazing.
This incredible body of work.
I really appreciate the integrity.
Everything you do is well done.
You guys do a great job.
We love it. What can we say?
He's Chris Mannix.
He's employed by Sports Illustrated.
The announcer's got it in for me.
There you go.
This is the Crossover NBA Podcast.
You have a problem with it? Build a team that can beat them.
Hosted by the one and only.
Oh, thank God.
Thank God.
Chris Mannix.
All right, welcome back. Another episode of the Crossover Podcast, second bubble edition episode. I am here in Orlando inside the bubble, the first official week where media members can walk around, go to practices. I wrote a little bit about it on SI.com earlier this week. You can check out that story and be writing a lot over the next month plus, if you will, maybe longer, depending how long I'm inside this bubble. Just a lot of interesting things going on and a lot of things to talk about as we kind of head towards the first scrimmages this week and the resumption of the regular season on July 3rd. To talk about that and much more, bring in one of my bubble mates here, Mark Medina, great writer over at USA Today. He is somewhere here on this campus. We can't record these in person, Mark, because we're still technically not allowed to be, you know, within, you know, 6 feet of each other, but that feels like more of a, you know, suggestion rather than the rule at this point.
Yeah, I guess if we were to do it in person, we would have to wear the credential with the beeper, and that would cause all these audio issues because that would go off. At least my first time at media availability to practice, it felt like every other second it was going off. And I remarked to an NBA PR staffer, I said, thank God they're not giving us these like electrical pricks every time we violate the social distancing norms, because it would just be a mess after that.
Well, it was strange that first night you were there at the pool. The NBA had kind of a media social for the first night out of quarantine, and we're all kind of sitting there. We're all wearing the beepers. They're all fully charged, and you know, conversations were abruptly halted by the sound of beep 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 beep. It's just like a truck backing up, you know, when you're in the middle of a conversation. But look, I don't blame the NBA. I mean, you better safe than sorry is their mantra down here, and you know, given the stakes and all this, I mean, they've got to take as many precautions as possible, right?
Oh, without a doubt. And, you know, I think for at least my comfort level going into this trip, a lot of it had to do with the fact that, look, nothing is risk-free in this world right now. But I think the NBA, for the most part, has done all it could for its preparation. Once I got down here, I felt like it reconfirmed all that because, you know, for the players that went out of the bubble inadvertently, they held those guys accountable. The safety protocols for all of us are very extensive. So even if there is a feeling of Groundhog's Day of, you know, getting tested every day, and when we were in quarantine, the three meals outside your door, you know, what I kept in perspective of, look, there's a lot, you know, worse things going on. So I'm just grateful I'm in this position. But B, it showed that, you know, the NBA has dotted its I's and crossed all its T's to make sure that they have the best chance to pull this off.
Yeah. And look, I think a lot of their rules that are in place right now are written in pencil more than they are in pen. I mean, the situation where players can't go to another team's hotel, like, I don't think that rule is going to last much longer than this week. I understand why it's in place now, but once these guys start scrimmaging against each other and they're having contact with each other on the floor, I think the NBA is going to relax some of those restrictions. And I think a lot of players will appreciate that. I had that conversation with Fred VanVleet with Toronto just the other day, and I think there are a lot of players like that that would like to interact with players on other teams. I mean, whether it's an ex-teammate that's somewhere else, a friend that's somewhere else, I mean, they would like to have these restrictions loosened so that they can, you know, spend some time with other people.
Yeah, I think a lot of it really depends on the success rate. And so far, so good. I mean, that was encouraging news with, you know, the NBA announcing this week that there were zero positive cases since last week. But I've tried to remind myself, look, it's way too early to proclaim a victory lap by any means, because this is going to go on to what, October 13th, the last possible day for the NBA Finals. So even if the NBA has all these well thought out plans and they are flexible, as you pointed out, and can etch things in pencil to either loosen things up or restrict them, just this pandemic has had a life of its own. And when you're talking, you know, this is going to go on for 2+ months, a lot of things could happen for better and for worse.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, players who seem to be, you know, finding stuff to do right now, whether it's fishing or, you know, working out in their room, like doing different things, like that's going to pass. Like, you're going to get bored and, you know, be looking for something to do. That's why I think it is important when we get past that first round for those teams that are still around to get their friends and family inside the bubble. Like, they're going to need, you know, some kind of a burst of energy, and that's going to be provided by friends and family. I'm curious to see what some of the younger guys do. Like, do they ask for like a 2-week pass for a quote friend to come in for to hang out in the bubble, or do they bring friends with them? I mean, that's going to be an interesting thing to watch when we get past that first round. But for now, it seems like guys are managing, but we are just you know, a week plus into all this. Tell me about your first few days here in the bubble. Was it what you expected? Was there any surprises? I mean, what did you like? What did you dislike about, you know, the media experience inside the bubble?
You know, I was expecting what I've seen so far, that it would be surreal just seeing practices at a ballroom and then going to these different facilities or venues that were more appropriate for practices. So I think my first day, I wasn't surprised that there was going to be this mix of excitement of a first day of school, first day of training camp feel, but then this weird tentativeness. When I was at the Lakers and the Rockets practice, you know, they opened up, I felt a little gun shy of like, hey, where should I be standing? Am I in the right place? And I wanted to see whatever I could on the court. And then that awkwardness of, we know 6 feet is the requirement for social distancing, but, you know, it's not like we're bringing out measuring tape with that. It's all feel. So, you know, there was this awkwardness for group scrums of how much distance should there be. And I remember when, you know, I was part of the interview scrum with LeBron James, a few reporters and I felt like we were doing the social distancing, because we're used to how just very compact it is for LeBron in normal circumstances when you have, what, like 30 reporters. And when the interview ended, the NBA said, hey, look, like, you guys need to spread out even more. They even started marking duct tape as like assigned spaces that we could stand in. You know, there were some other logistical hiccups where, you know, as you know, Chris, before these in-person practice interviews were taking place, we all had to log into Zoom and, you know, raise our hand and know how to unmute and mute. And we were still being told, even if we're there at practice, we still needed to log into Zoom so that the moderator could see us raising the hand, because the moderator is not there in person. But then that created all these audio issues that the NBA PR staff members quickly pivoted and said, you know what, just raise your hand in person. I'll relay to the moderator. So I was expecting all those weird small messes, but I think it was just cool to be able to see basketball for once. It seemed like such a thing I took for granted, you know, being on the beat day to day, and you go to a shoot around or a practice every day, you get used to it. But there was a novelty of just seeing that exist again.
Yeah. And I loved the first few days. Like, I haven't asked for too many one-on-ones yet with players, but you're not going to get LeBron. You're not going to get Anthony Davis. You're probably not going to get Giannis, but like everybody else, it seems like it's on the table. Like, I've had a pretty good reaction from PR staff. They've asked me, like, what do you need? Do you need somebody? And I've kind of wrote the first couple of days, like, the scene. I went to, I think, 4 practices on Monday, tried to go to 5, but blew the Oklahoma City one in the morning. That was a epic fail on my part. But like, the
Humbleson's feelings hurt.
Yeah, I got a text from, well, it's funny, like, to go even deeper in the weeds, like, the practice schedule says 9 to 12, and on day one I'm like, all right, I'll get there about 12:15. I got a text from Matt Tumbleson at like 11 a.m. being like, you here? I'm like, no, No, I thought we were out of 12. So you learn pretty quickly. Like, there's a lot. I mean, God, I was wandering around looking for the bus stop, looking for the walking path to get to one of the practice facilities. I mean, it takes, like, I was thinking just this morning, I was recording this on Wednesday morning, like, I have just figured out how to get from my room to the testing room without, you know, getting lost in a maze of wrong turns. Like, it's a weird setup here because it's kind of like a bunch of big circles that you're in, and it's tough to navigate. I just figured out on day three the most direct path to get to the testing room. But I'll tell you, the practices have been great. Like, you know, getting access to these guys in small group settings has felt pretty valuable so far. I think it's going to only get more valuable. Yeah, I don't know about you, but I was worried coming down here, would it be worth the cost? I mean, our outlets are paying a premium to get us into this space. It's certainly much appreciated, and you want to provide value, you know, for your outlet when you're down here. But I was worried a little bit, like, what kind of, you know, access would we get? Would it be worth it? And based on what we've seen in practice, and based on, and we'll talk about this in a minute, but what the arena looks like, I think there's pretty high value in being down here and being a part of all this.
I wholeheartedly agree. And look, we're all shooting our shots of interviews and ideas, and we're probably dealing with a low shooting percentage because of the logistics here. But if nothing else, just being able to see it firsthand, that helps give us the perspective of how the NBA is running this thing, number one. Number two, you know, I was among a few writers, and I think you were there as well, where we saw a glimpse of what the early game operations will be like at the arena. That's still subject to change, but just having that perspective helps. And then, you know, it sounds weird because you'd like to have these prolonged interviews, but I think especially as time goes on, the fact that coaches can at least just see us in person, players see us in person, I think that'll go a long way. And, you know, I think in the times that we're in, even though we all have our own jobs to do, the feeling that I got once I got down here is everyone in their own, you know, respective party has this feeling of, hey, we're all in this together. Like, there are things that aren't going to work out or things that get rescheduled, but everyone seems to have all the good intentions into trying to make it worth our time and vice versa. And I think for a larger, you know, standpoint of just making this whole operation work. So I'm pretty excited, you know, not only to see basketball, it's been a long time, but to be a part of this, because I think there's a lot of interesting stories to tell firsthand.
All right, so let's talk about the arena. We both got our first look at what the main arena looks like on Tuesday. There are three arenas down here where games are going to be held, and the setup is the same in all three. The NBA's got a freshly designed court, the NBA logo in the middle. The phrase Black Lives Matter is imprinted in large letters across center court by the scorer's table. And I was curious about what the NBA would do about the empty seats. There really aren't any. There are big, giant screens in front of the crowd section, in front of the stands on one side. The other side of the stands, you do have some seating there for broadcasts, for media that's in the first tier like us, for media that's in the second tier that's going to be coming, sitting up in the upper deck, which isn't a bad seat, by the way, for media members that might be listening to this. It's not a terrible seat. It's not like you're in the upper deck of Madison Square Garden. It's like you're in the upper deck of like a high school arena in some ways. It looks pretty cool. I mean, there is some stuff the NBA is certainly tinkering with about how to introduce crowd noise, how to introduce an interactive experience with fans. But I walked out of that arena, Mark, thinking this could be a pretty cool setup and could be and will be a unique experience for these guys.
Yeah, I came away with a really good impression. I mean, the most important thing is the basketball court's the same, the basket's the same, so that doesn't change. But as far as all the dimensions, I think that they did as good of a job as they could to make up for the reality that there's no fans. And, you know, I was told a few months ago when the whole idea of Orlando being this site for the resumed season that logistically it wouldn't be as big of a deal to have the games in these venues without fans because the capacity crowd for these events are in like 8,000 to 10,000. That's much different than an NBA arena. So I think that makes it a little easier for the NBA to kind of camouflage of putting the giant screens. And then in certain sections of empty seats, just it's very dark lighting. You can't even see it when you're watching on TV. But the other takeaway I had is it just reinforced how seriously they're taking all the safety protocols. I mean, each individual bench is 6 feet away, and you know they're having plexiglass on the scores table. I believe they're having plexiglass for the announcers table as well. So it just reinforces, like, they're looking at every little nook and cranny of, okay, how do we maximize safety here while also somehow pulling off having games.
It is weird to see, as you mentioned, like, each seat on the bench, there's an assigned seat for each player, and they are separated by, I believe, 6 feet. It's a little weird to see players who are out there on the floor, you know, banging into each other, and, you know, once the mask is off here, so to speak, like, it's off. Like, you know, you pulled the ripcord already on interacting with guys. Like, it's a little weird to see a not normal bench out there. But look, I guess that's something that also I think could evolve in time as this thing moves forward. But it was a pretty cool setup. And I'm curious to see, like, you know, which teams are more affected than not. You know, there are some questions directed at Danny Green at Lakers practice the other day about, you know, how shooters are affected. I mean, you know, shooters, you know, there are different light setups in different buildings, but, you know, the sight lines could be really unique. I mean, will be really unique in a situation like this, because if there are, you know, whether it's pictures of fans on the screen or just bright neon lights behind the backboard, I mean, that could, you know, potentially have an impact on how these games are played.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the other obvious part of this is just how everyone copes with no fans. I mean, a lot of the players that I've talked to on the Zoom calls, they acknowledge they're so used to feeding off the fans to, you know, get cheers and adrenaline when they're not playing well, and vice versa. They're used to handling that sort of pressure. So it seems like a lot of the benches are being instructed to be like the de facto cheerleaders of trying to muster up some other energy. And then the coaches are kind of on the other end of the spectrum. Frank Vogel was saying on a conference call the other day, when I asked him about this, is he was saying, look, I'm so used to in playoff games having to yell out plays because no one can hear me. And here, because the TV feed's going to pick it up, other coaches from the other team can hear, and other players, I feel inclined to whisper those play calls. But it seems to me that at least after the first 2-3 days, all those things will be sorted out, and I think that they will adjust fine. I have the larger question of how are the teams going to adapt to just getting their conditioning up to speed, the rustiness, getting the timing down, and that seems like it's going to be an ongoing process.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to learn more about that part of the players when we get to see these scrimmages firsthand starting midweek. I have the same question. Like, right now we're in that, like, everything is awesome phase. Like, everyone's in great shape. I have not heard, you know, I haven't talked to every team, but I've not heard from one team about, like, some guy that's just completely out of shape that'll be exposed some in the scrimmages. And certainly when you get into the seeding games, like, that will be interesting to see. The other part of, you know, the arena experience, I wrote about this last week, is the, you know, the referee interaction. Like, yeah. And Scott Brooks said this, the other day, where he's like, you know, I think maybe it was Vogel, actually. You know, assistant coaches get away with a lot, you know, sitting on the sidelines. Like, they curse out referees too, just don't get hurt because the crowd blends, you know, their reactions in. Got to be careful there. And talking to Monty McCutcheon, the VP of referees, like, he acknowledged that referees are going to have to, you know, pull back a little bit on some of their reactions. They hear something that may not be, I believe his words were, grammatically correct. You've got to kind of, you know, ease off a little bit. Like, some of the respect for the game rules are still going to be in place, right? You can't run up to a referee and stomp your feet at him. You can't run up to a referee and clap your hands in front of him or do something demonstrative with a motion. But if you, you know, say MF bullshit or something like that, if you start, you know, if you say something that you just as a reaction, referee is going to have to, I think, go a little easier. Also, we're going to see a run on technical fouls like never seen before. Like, you're going to have assistant coaches tossed on a regular basis if referees, you know, hold these guys to the same standard they had during the regular season.
Yeah, I'm really curious how this whole setup's going to, like, affect behavior modification. Like, Alvin Gentry the other day, the Pelicans coach, was saying, because the live mics are going to pick up on everything, I'm going to be very polite to the officials to show that I'm the good guy. So you wonder, will it be the other end where you're going to see coaches try to apply so much gamesmanship and maybe be, either passive aggressive or effusive with praise to try to like win the officials over at the beginning of the game. But then it just seems inevitable. Emotions are emotions, especially late in the game, that you feel like it's inevitable that we're going to see some sort of fireworks that, you know, the TV feeds will pick up on. And that's where I'm curious on where the NBA and the broadcast partners draw the line of what's fair play or not. I mean, I think on one hand, this would be a great recipe for more access because there's no fans. You can hear everything. The NBA wants to promote, you know, their product during this time to partly to recoup those financial losses. But I would imagine that the coaches and players have feelings that they want some of those sanctities to be protected. I remember what was in the 2018 NBA playoffs when the TNT feed caught Warriors coach Steve Kerr talking to Kevin Durant about trusting his teammates and bringing up his experience playing with Michael Jordan and how he learned that. That was writing's gold. I loved it. But Steve Kerr was upset that got out. So was Kevin Durant, unsurprisingly. And you wonder, you know, what have been the conversations with those partners on what's fair play or not.
Yeah, that'll be interesting. I'm sure there'll be a delay no matter what on these broadcasts. I know there is a delay on these broadcasts that to prevent, you know, too many curse words from getting out onto the air. But yeah, that's always a tough needle to thread because you want to show something interesting, but you don't want to show something that's going to get a team or a coach or a player upset at you. It's like what happened with Sam Darnold, you know, during the football season when he said, "I'm seeing ghosts everywhere." Like that was great content, but you know, the Jets, Sam Darnold at the time were not all that thrilled. So it'll be a fine line that broadcasters, I'm sure, we'll have to walk. Let's talk for a second about what I think is the most interesting team out here, and that's Portland, because you know they have become like the sexy pick, not just to make the playoffs, but to advance in the playoffs, and that would likely mean they would have to beat the Lakers in the first round. I know Charles Barkley has, in his infinite wisdom, come out and said the Blazers, if they're in the playoffs, will knock off the Lakers. Danny Green has said that, you know, we don't want to play Portland in the first round. That's the team that we don't want to touch. And I get that. I mean, just before the pandemic hit, you know, during the Kobe night at Staples Center, I mean, Damian Lillard went off in that game. I mean, that guy is a straight assassin in the postseason. CJ McCollum is a scorer. The Lakers just lost two guards, including, you know, one of, if not their best defensive guard in Avery Bradley. And you throw in the great unknown that is Jusuf Nurkić and Zach Collins. Like, these guys were not playing before the pandemic hit, and now they're back and presumably full members of that Blazers rotation. So how seriously should we take the Blazers? Not just as a team that can make the playoffs. Right now, they're 3.5 games behind Memphis. The Grizzlies did just lose Justice Winslow. That's a big loss for them moving forward. But not just to make the playoffs, but maybe just upset the apple cart completely and beat the Lakers in the first round.
I feel like everything's on the table. And with Portland, you know, Damian Lillard's always good for not only just getting a consistent 25 a night, but a game where he goes off for 40, right? Apparently, Carmelo Anthony's slimmed down. I mean, we have to take all these things for what it's worth because we have to see what that means for conditioning. But that's at least an encouraging sign that he's taking care of himself. They have their front court coming back. If I had to take a guess, though, I still have the Lakers winning the first round against Portland. I felt that even though I think everything's on the table because this is just a very screwed up set of circumstances, I'm hesitant to rank teams' depth charts with injuries only because I feel like that's going to happen every day where there's a new injury that comes into play. So as long as, you know, the star guys are still there, they're still going to be the favorites, right? But where I think those depth charts go into play is with this playoff race, you know, between Memphis, between New Orleans, Portland, Sacramento. I mean, it seems like Sacramento should just, you know, kind of call it cold here. I mean, they've been having a lot of challenges to open this season, and the news with Marvin Bagley being out for the rest of the resumed season. But I think for the larger contenders, I wouldn't rule out an upset, but until one of those star guys, something happens dramatically to them, I would still go chalk, at least in those early rounds.
Yeah, Portland got a bit of a gift. It just seems like the basketball gods are trying to get the Blazers into the playoffs, right? Like Sacramento, as you mentioned, whether it's Bagley being done, De'Aaron Fox with the injury, they're starting to get gutted out there. The Pelicans still have no idea when Zion Williamson is going to come back, and when he comes back, how long is his quarantine going to be? I think it's curious the NBA doesn't really have an answer for that, because it is spelled out in that 113-page memo that when you have a medical absence, if you're being tested, it's a four-day quarantine. But, you know, when I asked the NBA for specifics on Zion's return protocols, it still is murky for their part. So you got that. The Spurs aren't really a threat at this point. Phoenix, just happy to be here, probably. Like, it's just like, it's being kind of set up that, you know, you get into a play-in situation against Memphis, and, you know, Justice Winslow isn't the engine that drives that team, but he's a part of it. And, you know, you're asking Ja Morant to do a lot in a series like that against the Blazers, having to face off with two of the best guards in the league. So I think it's being set up nicely to get that first-round matchup between the Blazers and the Lakers. And look, my head says you're right, that the Lakers' stars will carry the day. And if this was, you know, mid-March, I'd probably fully believe that, because LeBron was playing great. AD was playing great. You know, the Lakers were rolling. They beat the Bucks. They beat the Clippers. But I don't know what kind of condition those guys are going to come back in. And look, we can poo-poo the absence of Bradley and Rondo, but it puts a lot more pressure on LeBron. Like, he's going to be asked to be even more of a ball handler. He's going to ask to be maybe even more of a defender against a Lillard or a McCollum in a situation like that. You simply can't, you know, roll Alex Caruso and J.R. Smith and Dion Waiters into that slot opposite Danny Green and expect them to, you know, provide the highest of level defenses. So I think this is, I mean, let's put it this way. If, as we kind of put in our requests for first round matchups, I'm going Lakers Blazers as often as they'll let me. Like, I am all in on that first round matchup, if that happens.
So even if Zion Williamson comes back in time for this, you wouldn't want Pelicans Lakers?
No, because I don't, look, the Pelicans, like, I think they'd just be happy to be there too. Like, it's like Zion, great. You get to see the Zion show for like four or five games. But I don't think they're a real threat to the Lakers. The Blazers are a real threat. Like, that's an experienced playoff team. And, you know, just watching it again, we get into practices. We get in the last 15 minutes. We don't see much more than one-on-ones and, you know, some individual drills. But, you know, watching Zach Collins, he looks okay. I mean, he, you know, and that's a guy that was vital to that team's success last year. So, I don't know. I mean, I'm fascinated by it. I'd probably still pick the Lakers, but, I mean, imagine if the Lakers lost game one. Like, if they put themselves in an 0-1 hole against that team, I mean, that's a tough one to climb out of.
I wholeheartedly agree. I mean, I slightly disagree that I'm still rooting for Pelicans just because of the storylines of Zion. Pelicans-Lakers first-round matchup just because of Zion. Anthony Davis seeing the former team. You know, the Pelicans' young core were all former Lakers. But I think you can't go wrong with either. Like, they are fascinating across the board. And I think when you're looking at this whole league, it seems like there's going to be like three tiers of kind of teams that we're going to be seeing, which will make for this weird disjointed mess where you'll have like the championship contending tier of teams that are trying to toe the line of, look, they're not going to be like sitting their guys during these games because they're trying to rev them up, you know, their engines up since they've been in the garage since March. But they're not going full blast 40 minutes a night because there's no real home court implications. And I think mathematically the Lakers are going to have the one seed anyway because they're 5.5 games over. But then you're going to have like that second tier of Portland, New Orleans, Memphis, whoever else could sneak into the playoffs, where the games might look ugly because they're out of shape, but it's just competitive and you just see everyone's heart being thrown into it. And then that third tier where, you know, your guy Scott Brooks of the Wizards and like the Phoenix Suns and the Spurs, like, I don't know what incentivizes those teams to really show up. I mean, they can say, oh yeah, we're trying to build habits for next season. But I mean, hey, we don't even know when next season will be. I mean, they say tentatively December, but that's all up in the air. And I just don't see, because of what's going on in the world, that they wouldn't be more inclined to think, hey, let's just get the hell out of here in one piece.
Yeah, I mean, in talking to Scott Brooks last week, I think there's a lot of value for his young guys to get to the playoffs. And they don't have to worry about Bradley Beal playing X number of minutes, Davis Bertans playing X number of minutes. The guys that are here are going to play big minutes for them. So I could see them, you know, maybe doing a couple of interesting things to get into the playoffs, or at least get into a play-in situation with the Nets. But it's just, it's We don't even need to talk about the back of the Eastern Conference. It's just not competitive at all. Milwaukee, whoever they play, is going to get a nice, easy cakewalk into that second round, a nice long break before they go into a second round matchup. Let me ask you this. The NBA has decided that the league voting, the league awards, are going to be based on just what we've already seen. Like, nothing over the next eight games that are played are going to be factored in to the NBA awards, which has kickstarted the LeBron versus Giannis MVP debate. Giannis checks a lot of statistical boxes. You can make an argument, and the Bucks would, that he's Defensive Player of the Year. Do you think there's a debate here? Do you think that this is a race that is ultimately going to be close for MVP?
I think it's going to be close, and I don't think that there's necessarily a wrong answer here, because I think that Giannis and LeBron both have equally – I wouldn't say equally, but they have compelling cases, right, where Giannis is clearly the better defender. There's no debating that. You know, he's been able to build off of last year's playoff exit where, you know, it seems like when I've been at Bucks games and talked to the coaching staff that he's found – more ways to navigate through double teams and all the, you know, coverages that he's getting to still be Giannis. But I think with LeBron, you know, there is a case to be made that not just because at 35 years old, his 17th season, and he's leading the league in assists, but all the extra things that he had to help the Lakers navigate, where maybe on paper it looks like, hey, it's just he and Anthony Davis rolling the ball out, but there were a lot of new role players that there were question marks on. And I think that you can make the case that LeBron's presence helped bring the better versions of those guys out. You know, Frank Vogel deserves a lot of praise, and I think he is a Coach of the Year candidate, probably behind Nick Nurse. But, you know, LeBron getting everyone to buy into that went a long way, because you remember he wasn't the Lakers' first coaching staff choice. And it was really weird how that was put together, because they were trying to impose which assistants that he should have and all that. And so there was a feeling that going into the season that, you know, how does Frank Vogel get these guys to buy in, which sounds absurd because he had great credentials in Indiana, but some of those things trace back to LeBron's leadership, as well as, look, the Kobe Bryant tragedy has hit everyone, you know, really hard this in the whole league, but he was a Laker luminary, and there's a lot of behind the scenes people and obviously players that had a tough time getting through all this. And, you know, from what team accounts say, he played a large part in helping the team galvanize together. But I don't think there's necessarily a wrong choice. Like, I'm still kind of debating. I've leaned toward LeBron at certain times. I've leaned toward Giannis. But I don't think that if any of those guys get it, that the other person should feel like they got screwed or anything.
Yeah, I'm not sure how you don't vote for Giannis. I mean, LeBron is a great story, right? Like, at 35 years old, to do what he's doing, and I agree with you, it's not just like LeBron, Anthony Davis, nothing else matters. Like, chemistry matters. And LeBron has played an instrumental role in developing and putting this team together really quickly. There are a lot of new faces on this Lakers team. A lot of faces brought back that, you know, weren't the greatest of players last year with the Lakers. Rajon Rondo hasn't had a great statistical year with the Lakers. So I give LeBron a ton of credit for that. Giannis checks so many boxes. I mean, statistically, he is having the kind of year that we haven't seen since like Shaq in the early 2000s. Like, he's putting up 30 points per game. What is it? 11, 12 rebounds per game. He's averaging right around 6 assists. And again, he might be the Defensive Player of the Year. Like, there's a lot of you know, obvious reasons to vote for Giannis. And look, I went to Laker practice on Tuesday and I asked a few people there, like, give me your best argument for LeBron being MVP. I asked Anthony Davis, and Davis pointed out, you know, exactly what I said. Like, what he's doing at age 35 is remarkable. It's a tremendous story. I'm like, all right, that's true. And that's a huge part of LeBron's season. But to me, that's not enough to move him past Giannis. I asked Danny Green. Danny Green says the NBA kind of owes him one. I'm like, well, that's true too. Like, I believe that he's probably been robbed of at least one MVP. But that's not enough of an argument to vote for not vote for Giannis. Frank Vogel had maybe the strongest argument when he was pointed out that LeBron is the quarterback of the offense and defense. He said it was like having Tom Brady offensively and Mike Singletary defensively. I'm not sure why he went with Mike Singletary there, but whatever. Like he made a strong argument there that LeBron is the glue to everything on that team. No matter how talented Anthony Davis is, LeBron is the glue guy on both ends of the floor. The team just doesn't work without him out there. But that, you know, hearing that, I didn't hear anything that made me believe that Giannis wasn't worthy of my vote. Now, I haven't cast my vote yet, but it's going to be really hard for me not to vote for Giannis and his second straight MVP.
Is there anything that can help you change your vote or no?
I don't know. I mean, like, like Giannis, like there's really no category that LeBron eclipses Giannis in. Like, yes, he's the leading assist leader, and that's a tremendous accomplishment in and of itself. But Giannis, the playmaker too with that team, the 6 assists a game is a pretty nice number for a, you know, basically 7-foot power forward. And I also looked at, like, I mean, Giannis, he's got a good team around him and a team that's been together for a while. But, I mean, let's compare Giannis's number 2 to LeBron's. Like, it's not even close. Like, Chris Middleton's a nice player, but Anthony Davis is a stud, an all-NBA top 5 talent. So I think that's another kind of check in Giannis's box. I mean, I've thought long and hard about, you know, finding a way to vote for LeBron. I think he's had this kind of year deserves some kind of recognition, you know, in the league award category. But, you know, Giannis isn't giving you any wiggle room there. Like, there's no breathing room, you know, to kind of, in my opinion, to give anybody but Giannis your vote.
Yeah, I'm going to just keep exhausting through all the numbers, because when the season, the week before the season ended, it seemed like, you know what, we're going to have a month's worth of clarity, because you had those matchups with the Bucks and the Clippers, and you felt like both players were starting to get ready for the playoffs, and there would be a clear direction of, like, separation maybe and more clarity of months of data. But now you just feel like when you hit the pause button, where do you go from here? And you lose not only that month's worth of games, but it's literally the rules right now where the NBA is saying we can't it's not based off of this resumed season. So I've been leaning toward LeBron because of, I think, more of the intangibles. And before that, I was leaning toward Giannis because of the on-court production that you outline there, but it's a really tough decision. I don't think, you know, anyone's in the wrong here, because the margin between the two is, you know, so close.
Yeah, I'm curious what the voting is going to look like. Our friend Tim Bontemps with ESPN did a straw poll of media members before or right around when the pandemic hit, and it was overwhelmingly in support of Giannis back then. I wonder if a few months off has changed the minds of anybody. And you know, it does hurt. I agree with you. It does hurt LeBron that there wasn't that month plus to sway some voters, because the Lakers were playing great. Giannis was battling kind of a knee thing at that point, so maybe he would have sat out some games or coasted all the way to the finish. So that might have, you know, moved me anyway. That might have given me more reason to vote for LeBron. But at this point, he is just a dominant player, man. Like, he is just a utterly dominant player. And if you talk about guys that are the engines for their teams, like, that team doesn't work without Giannis. You've got Giannis out there, and more often than not, like, 4 shooters. You know, when you throw Brooke Lopez at the 5 spot, like, you built the entire team around one player, and that guy delivers every single night. So I'll be curious to see what that voting looks like. Mark, appreciate your time, man. I will socially distance see you at the scrimmages this afternoon and the rest of the week, as we maybe start to get a little bit of clarity on what these teams look like and what they're going to look like when the season resumes on July 30th.
All right, Chris, sounds like a plan. And I'll tell you what, I've been enjoying every day of this, but I will admit that it started to feel like Groundhog's Day. When we got in this morning for our test, I felt like that same day had happened the day before. And so I'm just gearing up for rinse and repeat.
Oh, it's going to be like that. We're going to have to find different ways to make it mixed up, because I've settled into a routine out here where it's wake up, try to get my testing done very early in the morning, and then go about my day. But it's, look, it is fun to hit 4 practices in one day and hopefully do a lot of that as this thing continues, man. So, Mark, I'll see you out there, man. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having me. See you soon.
at Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.